everybody to our new temporary courtroom. I'm glad you all were able to find it. And please bear with us if we have logistical mechanical things that we have to work out. This is our first time here as well. The first case up for argument is Volunteers of America versus Guard Sports, and we're ready to hear from the petitioner.
May it please the court. The issue presented here is how does the collateral source statute apply to the price differential that results from managed care contracts between healthcare providers and healthcare insurers?
Excuse me, could you just state your name for our recording?
My apologies, Your Honor. It's Peter Moyson of Hall and Evans for the appellants, Volunteers of America. In determining how the collateral source statute should apply to this price differential, we look first to the language of the collateral source statute, and then, as the court did in the Van Waters case, we look to the object to be obtained by the legislature and the legislative history of the statute. The statute itself was a reaction to the common law collateral source rule. The common law rule typically came into play in situations where a jury award made a plaintiff whole and then payments from a collateral source resulted in overcompensation of the actual economic losses. The common law rule reflected a policy determination that it is more just for a plaintiff to receive overcompensation than it is for a tortfeasor to escape accountability for paying actual economic losses. The collateral source statute reflects a very different policy determination that was made by the General Assembly. The policy determination behind the collateral source statute is that a plaintiff should be precluded from receiving overcompensation for economic losses.
Well, let me ask you this, counsel. Under the common law, of course, the actual reimbursement of actual economic losses has typically been the goal, isn't it?
Yes, Your Honor. The idea, the central tenet of tort law has always been to try to achieve full compensation for actual economic losses that are incurred by a plaintiff, yes.
So this idea of overcompensation is really used under the common law. It's interested in the basis of this statute.
If there a situation where there's been full compensation by a tortfeasor and then supplemental compensation from a source that was collateral to the tortfeasor, in which case you would end up with something more than 100% compensation.
That would be atypical, would it not? I mean, even under the common law, there was a reason, there was a mechanism for adjusting that, but the payment was not. Non-economic damages, other elements of damages take care of the other types of remedy or damages that go for other things other than plainly just reimbursing, in this case, the doctor or pharmacy.
Well, actually, now under the common law, you would have situations, absent a situation where there's subrogation, where you've got a pure reimbursement, and so there should not be a net windfall to the plaintiff. If there's some sort of collateral supplementation that is not subject to subrogation, then you could have, under the common law rule, overcompensation to the plaintiff. The collateral source statute accomplishes this policy goal by requiring that a jury award be reduced by the amount of indemnification that a plaintiff receives from a collateral source. The General Assembly included two very limited exceptions to this rule regarding mandatory reduction of verdicts.
Counsel, I know you're going to work through language of the statute, and I think you're moving on to the exception language. And I just wondered if you would spend some time talking about the language that qualifies to commence with. That is, you just indicated indemnification, but it actually is indemnified or compensated for his loss. And I guess I just want to make sure when you're talking about whether the exception applies, if you also talk about whether it qualifies to commence with. Source.
Thank you, Your Honor. That is something that I wrestled with for a time as to whether or not this price differential can be considered indemnification in the first place. because if you don't get to that point, then really you're not, there's no basis to apply the collateral source statute itself. And I think the reasonable conclusion is that the price differential is a form of indemnification. It's something that the insured person is being covered for, and absent the insurance policy, there would be no indemnification for that price differential in theory. A person would be paying 100 cents on the dollar, and with the health insurance, they're indemnified for 100 cents on the dollar. So then I think we get to the contract exception, which asks the question that that price differential, is that something that comes within the contract exception? So I think it is, the reasonable conclusion is that it is a form of indemnification that falls within the first general part of the statute.
Would you stick with that just a minute and explain that a little more? I understand you're conceding that that's what you've concluded, but I didn't understand exactly why you considered that indemnification.
Sure. Indemnification means that you're covering somebody for a loss. And in this case, it's an economic loss. The situation arises when a jury has made a determination that the reasonable value of the medical services is whatever it is, 100 cents on the dollar. The health insurance provides indemnification for that full 100 cents on the dollar. And so in that sense, I've concluded, and I hope the court does as well, that that comes within the ambit of the first half of the collateral source statute, that there has been indemnification from a source collateral to the tortfeasor for the 100 cents on the dollar.
So Patrick is doing the indemnifying?
I believe it has to be somebody collateral to the tortfeasor, yes.
So who would you say is indemnifying in that case? The hospital? I mean, the doctors? By reducing their bills?
Well, you've got some indemnification. That's an excellent point. Is it a combination? And I think it almost has to be viewed that way. It's a combination of the health care providers and the health insurers. Because between the two of them, they have reached an agreement that has the net effect of indemnifying the insured person for the 100 cents on the dollar.
And I guess my question there has to do with the, we've couched this entire argument in terms of the amount billed or the amount paid, but if it's the entity doing the billing, is that indemnification or is it billing less?
I'm not tracking that question. I'm sorry you lost me there at one point.
Let me ask it this way, if you don't mind, since we seem to be on the same track here. And that is the, I mean, you're quick to say it's indemnification. Apparently, you don't think it's compensation. You think it's indemnification. But why isn't instead just bargaining for a good price? I mean, why haven't they just come to terms as opposed to indemnifying the insured at all?
I see your point, Your Honor. The statute comes into play after a jury has made a determination as to the reasonable value of the medical services that have been provided. And so that's my starting point, is that this comes after the jury has done its job and the jury has determined 100 cents on the dollar for the services. Once that determination has been made, the statute asks the trial court to look at, was there some amount that was indemnified? To the extent that the insured plaintiff has been relieved of the obligation to make any payment whatsoever on that amount that was found by the jury to be the reasonable value of the services, then in my view, there's been indemnification for that amount.
To what extent does that rationale or explanation for why it's indemnification depend upon the initial presumption there, and that is that the jury has awarded 100%, that is, the jury has awarded the, if you will, the billed amount, the asking price?
That's, you can take any number. Let's say the bills or the statements show that there was a total of $100,000 in medical treatment. The jury comes back, like they did in the Tucker case, and say that there's a lesser amount that actually constitutes the reasonable value. So in this case, let's say the jury comes back with $85,000. If there's been full indemnification of that $85,000, that's the starting point for the application of the collateral source statute. So we say there's been indemnification for that $85,000, which was found by the jury, simply because the plaintiff is not responsible for that by virtue of the health insurance program. then we look to the contract exception and ask, what benefit was paid as a result of that health insurance contract? And that's where you factor in the amount that was actually paid according to the fee scheduling agreement.
That sounds a little bit like the insured has been indemnified for any amount that he has, that the jury has determined for which he doesn't actually have to pay.
Correct, Your Honor. I think that's the simplest explanation. When the statute's talking about how the trial court is supposed to look at the amount by which the plaintiff was indemnified, I think that's purely a function of what the jury finds to be the reasonable value of the medical services.
But would you explain the policy basis for that? What you're, that would allow more than what is actually paid, right? I mean, when you apply the exception, the plaintiff gets to keep it, right?
The way it works is that a jury can award more than what was paid, at least in theory, which is what happened in the Tucker case. The jury makes a determination, in my case, the Tucker case, based purely on the statements that were issued by the healthcare providers. In my case, we did not try to present testimony from financial officers, from the health insurers, or from the hospital as to the negotiated prices. We just simply did not go there because it seemed more efficient to just simply apply the collateral source statute post-verdict. That's what the trial court did in this case. The policy of the General Assembly, I think, was to eliminate excess recovery over and above the actual economic loss. And I don't believe the General Assembly foresaw this kind of managed care price discount.
And just place that policy of the General Assembly in the context that is being moved to press this.
Yeah, Senator Micheljohn spoke up, and he's the reason I think we had the contract exception. The majority on the panel simply wanted to prevent any kind of recovery by the plaintiff for anything that had been paid for by a collateral source. And Senator Micheljohn thought that was a bit unfair in certain circumstances. And he pushed and succeeded in convincing the rest of the panel that there should be an exception in cases of subrogation, which makes sense. And also there should be an exception in situations where somebody's made an investment and they contracted for receipt of that benefit at some future time. And those are the two exceptions that Chief Justice Rivera discussed in his special concurrence in the Van Waters case.
And the majority in Van Waters quotes President Clinton's testimony. And he's very expansive because he describes several situations in which he thinks it would be unfair. And then mentioned Social Security, I think that 4 or 5 things. It seemed to me that his description was so broad that he was pretty swallowed.
That's the thing I think that Chief Justice Rivera was trying to pin down. What was the principle of the laundry list that Senator Micheljohn spoke about during the committee hearings? And
yes, but he was all by himself.
And true.
So, I mean, I do Facebook and Gordon didn't get it, which was to rely on his
Oh, absolutely. But Van Waters did not address, I think, the principle that we're trying to get our arms around here. And I think Chief Justice Rivera was analytically correct. I don't know how important it was to the outcome of the Van Waters decision. But I think it provides a very useful analysis that provides guidance in our case. The critical features of the laundry list that Senator Micheljohn spoke about, first of all, subrogation, which you talked about at length. And then secondly, if we've got a contract that somebody has invested in on behalf of the plaintiff with the expectation that there be some sort of a payoff that the plaintiff would be able to pocket. And that, I think, is a critical issue in this case, because here the health insurers, the healthcare providers, and the insured person, none of these people expected that this price differential would end up being pocketed by the insured person as some sort of recovery in a future tort action. The fact of the price differential is something that's supposed to benefit the health insurer, In return, the health care provider gets certain benefits by yielding that price differential. But nobody intended for this to be something that would end up in the pocket of a successful tort plaintiff.
But isn't that something that the tort plaintiff comes for, like having the written foresight, whatever it is, to take this particular insurance?
I don't believe so. And in fact, Professor Dan Dobbs in the Treatise on Remedies addresses that very point, Your Honor. Professor Dobbs says that it's safe to assume an insured person is contracting for security when they take out an insurance policy, and that makes perfect sense. But in no sense can it be said that the insured person is bargaining with the hope of pocketing this price differential in some future tort lawsuit.
Well, sure, but I don't think any of us ever were signing up for health insurance in the region that we're going to be so it's but we are thinking, if we have a choice, I'm sure we're trying to pick one that would be the most effective of the insurance interest. That's the best deal for the insurer. I guess they had a choice if they had one that got a deeper discount than another one, how do we do that?
From an insured's point of view, and I understand the court's question, the point you're getting at, from an insured's point of view, what is it they're looking for? They're looking for the best bargain, the most security at the lowest price. My point is this notion that it's somehow an expectation on the part of anybody that this price differential would go in the pocket of a tort plaintiff, that never crosses anyone's mind. It's not a contractual expectation, and so therefore it should not fall within the contract exception in the collateral source statute. The contract exception talks pretty clearly about a benefit that's paid as a result of a contract that's entered into for the benefit of the insured plaintiff. Well, the contract entered into for the benefit of the insured plaintiff, if it's a benefit paid as a result of that contract, I think it's fair to require that that benefit be something that somebody had as a reasonable expectation of as being the outcome of that contract. And that's simply not the case with this price differential. Nobody expected that to be a benefit. It's sort of a surprise or accidental benefit to certainly most insured people. As you just mentioned, Your Honor, people don't go in with the expectation that they're going to be involved in an accident, let alone a lawsuit. And most people would never consider the possibility that they're going to receive this price differential as something that they get to keep at the end of a tort case. That's certainly not the expectation going into the negotiations between a healthcare insurer or a healthcare provider. So that being the case, I just don't think it falls within that analytical pigeonhole of being an expected contractual benefit within the meaning of the contract exception of the collateral source statute.
Mr. Morrison, how does it fit into the expected investment benefit?
But that's the point. That's the
Exactly. So your argument is it's solely a windfall.
Well, I don't like to use the term windfall because it's a bit pejorative. But it's an unintended benefit of the insurance contract. And that's the principle or the pigeonhole I think that Chief Justice Rivera was trying to get at. There are certain contracts, clearly, that don't provide for subrogation. But they're the types of contracts that Senator Milkojohn wanted excluded from the general reach of the collateral source statute. And those, the distinguishing feature of those types of contracts is that people at the outset expected for the plaintiff to be able to pocket those benefits. That was the whole point of making the investment. I think AFLAC is that kind of a program where you get the money regardless of who's paying what your bills are. They just pay a fixed amount because you've invested in it and you're expecting to pocket that money in the event of an accident. This price differential doesn't fall in that category. It's completely different. The health insurer doesn't expect it.
Is it different than, your argument you're making is benefit paid. It's a benefit, not a benefit paid.
Correct.
How do you square that?
I don't see there's any conflict there. The plaintiff was actually receiving money. He was getting benefits paid to him, and it's something he contracted for by virtue of his employment. And the issue, I thought, in the Van Waters case was, since he didn't have the direct contractual relationship, that it arose by virtue of him, as, by virtue of his employment, does that come within the ambit of the statute?
Sure. It's like, when an insurer takes out health insurance, aren't they bargaining for reasonable medical services?
They're bargaining for coverage for reasonable medical services, correct.
So, isn't that the same thing?
I don't think so. Here's the distinction I would make. When the insured person takes out health insurance, to get back to Chief Justice Mulharkey's point, they're bargaining for coverage to some extent, 80%, 100%, whatever, of the cost of those services. They want that security, and that's what they're going for. They're not going for the type of fringe benefit or side benefit that was at issue in the Van Waters case.
They're not going for the fringe benefit or the side benefit of the of this compensation in a tort claim. That I don't have a problem with, but how are they not going for or bargaining for the, what I'm going to refer to as the reduction in the cost of the services? That is, the fact that they will have to pay, to use your terminology, I think, less than the reasonable value as a result of the contract that their insurance negotiated for them. Because after all, with some of these insurances, you know, there are deductibles and that sort of thing, and so they may actually still be paying part of that in their insurance company, you know, as far as their out-of-pocket costs. So are they not also picking the insurance company to the extent that anybody picks health insurance companies? Aren't they theoretically picking the insurance company because this one is negotiating for, you know, good prices, which will ultimately benefit them?
An insured person benefits from lower prices, hopefully, in the form of lower premiums.
Also in the form of lower medical payments if they are paying some portion of it themselves.
Yeah, if there's only partial coverage, 70% covered by insurance, 30% is covered by the insured person, then the analysis becomes a little bit more complex, or at least seems to. But I think we've still got the same issue, that we've got indemnification of X amount, be it 70% or 100%, and we've got a benefit that's paid. And the application of the statute is pretty mechanical, and I think it works out with, it fulfills the goal of the legislature that there not be an excess recovery. So if you've got a partial payment from the insurance company and you've got 30% being paid by the insured person, okay, we ask, to what extent was there indemnification? That's the first half of the statute. Well, there was indemnification for 70%. To what extent, then, do we reduce that? Well, we don't reduce it by whatever the benefit was paid under the insurance policy. So if they paid 70%, you don't have that kind of reduction. So it's just, it's, the numbers are a little bit different, but the policy requires that it be applied according to its terms, and I think it's pretty much the same net result.
Well, why don't you walk through that, if you would, please, because let's assume, what kind of evidence would be produced at trial, both the negotiated floor price and the bill price?
Well, the way we did it in the Tucker case, and I don't know if it's necessarily the right way to do it, but here we had a pretrial motion limine. The trial court ruled that it would apply the collateral source statute to this question post-trial. And so we did not go down the road of presenting any of this evidence to the jury. One alternative would be to present that evidence to the jury and let them make that determination. At the time, my reading of the collateral source statute was that the General Assembly's intent was to have the trial court do this post-trial. But there's really no reason why you couldn't do it during the trial itself. We just chose a different approach.
Well, what I wanted to say, so what do you suggest? You suggest pre-trial, post-trial, because I think it goes to the issue of measure of damage and what's presented, and really what the verdict then becomes upon which the collateral source would or would not be applied.
Well, in my
case, let's take your $100,000 example again and kind of work through it that way.
The $100,000 hypothetical is a good one, because in the Tucker case, the jury actually did conclude that some of the hospital's charges were a bit too steep, and so they cut that. And I think that it's appropriate, because the jury instruction we're using right now in trials asks the jury to make that determination. And so for them to be able to fulfill that function, it seems reasonable that they'd be allowed to hear evidence should the parties wish to present it, as to what really is the reasonable value.
Right, so the evidence presented was what the hospital would have billed but for the insurance contract, what the hospital did bill as a result of the insurance company, and then what the patient paid by virtue of the terms of that specific insurance policy.
That's not really worked in Tucker, and I think you've got a thicket if you try to introduce how much the plaintiff paid, because then people might wonder where that money came from. But I think it's fair to say tell the jury what the healthcare providers typically receive as payment.
But what I'm trying to factor in is this whole concept of the reasonable charge, and how do you anticipate that would be used or proven at trial, and then how would it collect? And then, assuming you come up with a number, how would you factor in closings?
The Consumer Protection Act for managed care programs talks about three different types of price categories: the negotiated price, the average price, and the price that people could charge, the retail, if you will, price. And I think it's probably prudent for people, litigants, to try to present that evidence if it's not too expensive in relation to what the case is worth. It can be an expensive proposition to try to bring in all that economic data and then have the jury try to sort through it. But that's the most accurate way for the jury to make a finding as to the reasonable value. Once that happens, though, then we can simply go back to how much post-trial, the collateral source statute, how much was indemnified in relation to whatever number the jury comes up with. If they were presented with $100,000, they conclude only $85,000 is a reasonable value. Post-trial, the trial court applies the collateral source statute and says, first, how much was indemnified? In this case, perhaps $85,000, perhaps less, under Justice Martinez's hypothetical that somebody's not getting 100% coverage. But whatever that number is, that's the indemnification. And then we look to the amount that was paid, the benefit that was paid, pursuant to the insurance policy. There's no reduction for the benefit paid. Anything that's a balance, there is reduction, yes. I think you can crunch the numbers under various hypotheticals, but I think it comes out pretty much the same way. You get the tortfeasor making a full payment for the actual economic losses, and it fulfills the General Assembly's intent that the plaintiff does not get overcompensated for an economic loss that never occurred. And really, that's the nub of it here. The price differential, we've called it phantom damages, and we picked that up from a Florida court. There's nothing pejorative about it. It's just simply the concept that it's a loss that never occurred. It's a bill that was never charged, and it's an amount that was never paid. And it just seems a little bit Alice in Wonderland to allow for a plaintiff to recover for a loss that never occurred and call that a compensation for economic losses. And I think in that sense,
yeah, that's just interesting to me. Still, I guess I'm stumbling a little bit with the notion that it's a loss that was never paid, never incurred, a bill that was never paid, but yet it is something for which there has been indemnification. Because you had to have that to get into the statute to begin with.
And perhaps that ties in.
That just seems to be contradictory.
I think maybe that ties in with the point that Justice Rice was making was, if it's not a real number, shouldn't the jury be the one to make that determination? And I think it's appropriate for the jury.
As you pointed out, they already have.
Right.
Out of the statute. So that determination has been that it's a reasonable value. And that reasonable value, if it happens to be 100%, includes an amount for which the insured has been indemnified, according to your interpretation of the statute. But that amount for which the insured has been indemnified is something for which there is no loss and has never been paid.
Right. And that's
so they've been indemnified, but they're not indemnified as a result or by a benefit paid.
Correct. And it's perhaps a conundrum. I've sort of puzzled about that myself. But I keep coming back to the point that the jury's already made a determination, right or wrong, as to what the reasonable value of the medical services is. If that's over and above the negotiated price, and that's the determination that was made by the jury. The idea of term indemnification in the first part of the collateral source statute, I think it should be interpreted broadly, or at least with a common sense definition or meaning of indemnification, meaning coverage for the value of something. And even though prior to the accident, the health insurer and the healthcare providers negotiated a price, and that's what they think the value is, in this case, the jury came up with a different number, a higher number.
I do understand where I'm stumbling is not on what the jury came up with, but it is instead on the notion that the insured has been indemnified, whatever that 100% or less is, that there is an amount for which the insured has been indemnified, but that indemnification is not as a result of a benefit paid.
Correct.
You're calling it indemnification, but you're saying it's indemnification not as a result of the benefit.
The distinction may be a difference that doesn't really make a hell of beans. I would word it slightly differently in the sense that for the contract exception to apply, there has to be a benefit paid as a result of a contract for the benefit of the plaintiff. The general reach of the statute requires a reduction for any indemnification, but we don't reduce the verdict by the amount of a benefit that was paid. And so here, I guess one of the fundamental points that I'm trying to make is that there is indemnification, but the price differential is not a benefit paid, and so therefore it has to fall within the ambit of the first half of the statute, not the second half of the statute. If there are no other questions, I'll yield the lectern. Thank you.
I understand the respondents are going to divide their time.
That is correct, Your Honor.
And we will have to keep track of their own time. The yellow light.
Thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate that. If it pleases the court, my name is Richard Lesh. My co-counsel, Ryan Nelson, is at the bench. We represent the estate of Richard Tucker. Richard Tucker died during the pendency of this appeal, but I will refer to him throughout the case as Mr. Tucker. We represent the respondents, and as I listened to the petitioner's argument, I was struck by two things. One, the intent of the collateral source rule is divided up into two parts. First, the first section is a broad-based exclusion of collateral sources, and it must be broadly construed, and the intent is to avoid double recoveries. But the contract exception to the collateral source rule has a separate intent, and the court in the Van Waters case described it as the intent is not to deny a plaintiff compensation to which is he entitled by virtue of a contract that he entered into and paid for with the expectation of receiving the benefits of that contract at some point in time. So when we analyze the contract exception, we don't analyze it with the idea that we're trying to avoid double recoveries. We analyze it in the context of ensuring that the contract exception to the collateral source rule is applied. I'm going to ignore the general facts of the case. I agree with Mr. Moisen that in the context of this case, does not deal with evidentiary issues, although I'm fully prepared to address those issues. It was not raised. The plaintiff simply introduced the amount of the medical bills by stipulation, introduced testimony from Dr. Crane, who recently did my knee surgery, but that these were reasonable and necessary. And so we introduced that evidence. That remained unrebutted, and then the trial court applied the collateral source rule afterwards.
It would seem, however, that starting point, the bills are not what's really paid. I mean, that's the way this whole insurance industry works.
Well, Judge, I think recently, yes, with the advent of HMOs in the middle of the late 80s, and these negotiated contracts began appearing between providers and HMOs, then these HMOs were able to negotiate payments less than the amount of the provider's bills. Up until that point, my recollection is when I first got into this business, is that insurance companies paid 80% of what's reasonable and necessary. But only with the advent of HMOs and the negotiated contracts did some injured parties have their bills paid at less than the full amount. People who were outside the network still paid the full amount. Uninsured people still paid the full amount. So it isn't that only people, that all plaintiffs, all injured parties pay a discounted amount. Only people who are provided insurance within their network and seek coverage within their network. There are two key points. One, we have to separate legal rights and contractual rights. A plaintiff has a legal right to recover the reasonable value of the medical services he receives. That's what the case law is for 100 years. That's what the jury instruction says. And that is a right that every plaintiff has. Some plaintiffs also have contractual rights, and they are entitled to the benefit of their bargain. Whenever we get confused in this argument, it's always because we confuse and try to combine those two in a way that doesn't make sense. So keep those two in mind and separate as we go through this.
Counsel, can I stop you there?
Yes, ma'am.
Can you help me understand then how the injured person contractually bargained for the amount billed as opposed to the amount actually paid? How do you envision that bargain occurring, or what is the insured thinking at that?
That was my second point, and it helps me answer your question by referring to that. What is the benefit that is bargained for by an insured in a contract with his insurance carrier? The benefit is not, I want the insurance company to pay $40 on my $100 bill. The benefit he seeks and that he bargains for is that if I provide or seek medical care within my network, I want relief from liability for the bill, 100%. I don't care as a bargainer whether my company pays $40 on a $100 bill or $80 on a $100 bill. I just want relief from liability for that bill. That's what I bargained for, and the state of Colorado requires that the contract between the provider and the insurance company contain provisions that hold them harmless for the balance of the bill. So that's where it comes up, Judge. Now, if I don't like my contract and I want to go outside my network, then I will only get a certain amount of payment for the bill, and then I'll have to pay the balance. But if I abide by my contract and choose an in-network provider, then I want the benefit, not only the amount that's paid to the provider, I want the amount that I know I don't want to have liability for any of the bill. The bill, the contract between the provider and the insurance company really isn't a, I'll tell you what it is. It determines who makes how much money in a transaction, who's the winner, who makes profit, who gets loss. The amount of money that the insurance company can pay, if it can pay a lesser amount, it makes more profit. If it has to pay more money, it makes less profit. The doctor, the less more he gets, the more profit he makes. That's the purpose of that contract. But it's Tucker's contract. It's the injured party's contract that results in, and the sole objective of his contract is not to have any liability for any of the bills that he incurs. I want to talk a bit about the benefit paid. All of these issues are both common sense. Actually, there are two issues, the benefit paid and whether or not the benefit results from Tucker's contract. I just dealt with that a little bit. All of these are matters of both common sense, and I'll go through that a little bit. But more importantly, they're matters of precedent. Van Waters versus Keelan is a very powerful case. And this court, well, I think, would have to overrule Keelan versus Van Waters in order to rule in favor of the VOA's position. Benefit paid. There's plenty of case law in other areas in which the word paid and benefit paid is construed to mean an advantage conferred by one party on another. The dictionary definition of benefit paid is the same thing, to bestow one thing of value in exchange for another. Forgiveness of indebtedness is a common bargain for consideration in contracts every day. There are many good examples of benefits that are paid that don't include a monetary compensation. an apartment manager who receives salary and free rent. What he really is getting is relief from the obligation to pay rent. What about Kaiser members? Kaiser members pay a premium for their coverage. They go to our Kaiser facility, and they don't receive payment, or nobody receives payment for the services that are provided to them. The Kaiser member is simply relieved of the obligation to pay for the medical bill. And to argue that that's not a benefit paid, I think, is a way too narrow scope of argument. The common sense analysis of whether or not it's Tucker's contract, not the contract between the provider and the insurer, that results in the benefit is very simple. If no more liability is the benefit to Tucker, then that contract, that benefit comes solely from his contract with Aetna.
Counsel, can I get you to move just to address the first part of the statute, the indemnification language? How do you read that language? Is there actual indemnification here for amounts that actually the insured will never be liable to pay?
I think indemnification and compensation is a concept that has to be read broadly in the context of the first sentence and in the contract exception. I think it more means more than just benefits paid. One can argue that compensation is the amount of money paid. One can argue that indemnification is the relief from the obligation to pay the balance. And I think that's a perfectly reasonable interpretation, and I think that's what the legislature meant when they put those phrases in both. And there's another reason why I would say that. We hear the words indemnification and hold harmless, once again, in contracts that we see every day. In fact, they almost always appear in the same sentence. The concept of hold harmless is codified in state law, in that the state law requires the insurer and the provider to hold harmless, to have a hold harmless clause, making sure that the insured doesn't have to pay the balance. So the concept of indemnification and hold harmless very logically applies to that part of the bill which Tucker is not obligated to pay.
Yeah, now help me understand that. I mean, if he never has to pay that, how is there indemnification for that portion? If the liability never occurs, if there's no obligation to pay in the first place, how can you be indemnified against that?
I first, Judge Justice, I think Tucker was obligated to pay that bill. The second he provided or received services from the hospital or from the doctors, he was obligated to pay the full amount of that bill. It is only by virtue of his insurance contract that he is relieved of the obligation to pay part of that bill. So I think it is a too narrow construction to say he never had an obligation to pay that bill. He did. It is only by virtue of his insurance contract that he didn't.
Isn't that moving a little quickly? I mean, is he obliged to pay the bill, or is he obliged to pay the reasonable value of services?
I apologize, Your Honor. You're right. He's obligated to pay only the reasonable value of the services, which may not be the amount of the bill. I would agree with that 100%. I think defendants ought to be able to challenge the reasonableness of the bill. I think they ought to be able to bring in, for example, there's one hospital that charges twice what other hospitals charge for MRIs. They ought to be able
but
to bring...
Isn't that, I mean, at least theoretically, by law, the case? Somebody's not insured, they get a bill, their obligation is a reasonable value that's subject to litigation, I suppose.
It would be interesting. If the doctor or the provider...
Often, but...
I think one of the defenses, an uninsured party would have to a suit by a provider of medical services would be that your charge is not reasonable and necessary. I think it absolutely is. It comes into play in every suit. I don't know if I've answered your question, Justice Hyde, but I hope I have. But okay.
Well, it's the reasonable value set by the market through this insurance industry. I mean, it really isn't what the hospitals and doctors want to do, is it? At all anymore?
That is a difficult question to answer, Justice Hobbs. The reasonable value of the market is subject to proof in every case. But one thing I am sure of is that the amount negotiated between an HMO and a provider is not representative of the reasonable value of the services. All it does is determine or represent the negotiating strength, the relative negotiating strength of those two parties. If I'm Blue Cross and, I'm sorry, Judge.
I'm sorry, I just couldn't help myself. Isn't that almost, you know, by definition, what reasonable value is? That is the price that the seller and the buyer agree upon?
It could, except that the insurance company is a bulk buyer. And the, bulk seller, or buyer, and the provider is a bulk seller. When I go to purchase a Chevrolet Suburban, I pay $50,000. But if I'm the procuring agent for the state of Colorado, and I want to go buy 10 Suburbans, I can probably get a $30,000 price for each of those cars. That's the way the HMO is. The HMO goes to the doctor, the healthcare provider, and says, I'm going to bring you 400,000 of my subscribers. They're going to be on my preferred provider list, and you're going to have the opportunity to be selected for that. And not only that, I'm going to make immediate payment, and I'm going to do your advertising. Now, since I'm providing all these services to you, doctor or hospital, what are you willing to reduce your price for in order to take advantage of those benefits? And the answer is, somewhere in there, there is a bulk price that the doctor or hospital is willing to give in exchange for being on this list. And also, not only in exchange for being on the list, but to avoid the hazard of not being on a list and not being selected by a lot of people who want to make sure that they don't have any liability for their bill. So the answer is, Justice Hobbs, that the negotiated price between an HMO and a provider is a bulk price. It's a volume discount. It is not representative of the fair market value of the services. When an uninsured party or an insured who's out of the network goes and pays for those services, he has to pay a certain value. How do you determine that? What's the hospital going to charge in the absence of this bulk discount?
I guess I'm having trouble with this because I view the common law as in economic damages to cover the out-of-pocket expense that the victim actually has to pay.
And I don't think, in an esoteric sense, I think that's true, but in a more practical sense, Judge, the jury decides the reasonable value of the medical bills, and those are the economic damages. Now, we move to the second half of the equation. Does anybody pay for them? How much are they paid? Those are secondary questions. But the economic loss, the damages in the case, are determined by the jury at the time of trial, as determined by the jury instruction. So, and if you refer to the economic loss as only the amount paid, then what you're not doing is giving credit to, and it hasn't been paid. I agree with that. It is a windfall to a certain extent to the plaintiff, but he's paid for that windfall. Relief from that obligation to pay is a benefit that his contract provides that he paid for.
Okay, ramifications on the cost of liability insurance. I haven't heard that discussed based on previous studies.
That's one I might leave Mr. Hansen to address. But I thought a little bit about that, and my thinking was that if there is one standard, the reasonable value of medical services, that the defendant is required to pay in every case, they can predict outcomes. They can predict and amass their reserves. On the other hand, if the amount that the defendant has to pay in every case varies with what kind of insurance the defendant had, or the victim had, the plaintiff had, and how strong his company was in negotiating discounts, then the amount that the defendant is going to have to pay will vary every case. How do you set reserves if you can't predict how much, if you don't know, you simply don't know who's going to be insuring a particular injured plaintiff at any given time. So I think it would be easier to predict results and set reserves than if you didn't. Now, effect on liability insurance, it will be the same as it's always been. He will still be responsible for the reasonable value of the services rendered. That defendant will still be able to, and you know, I see a couple of my former adversaries in here. These guys are good. I mean, they're going to come up with ways to contest the reasonable value of the services. They're going to, one of the one of the amicus briefs referred to a hospital administrator who says hospitals inflate their bills. Well, fine, call him, put him on the stand, qualify him, have him testify about how he knows, and make me cross-examine him. And if it's true that the medical reasonable value of the medical services was inflated, then by God, the jury won't award it. So the jury will be, the defense will be only responsible for what it's always been responsible for, the reasonable value of the services rendered. And I appreciate the quote I would like to give to Mr. Hansen. The rest of the time, he wrote an absolutely wonderful brief, at least in my opinion, and I would like to give him the rest of my time. Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Bill Hansen. I'm appearing as amicus curiae for the Colorado Trial Lawyers Association. I hate to do this, but I am going to disagree with Mr. Lesch to some extent. We are dealing with two contracts here. Two. One is the plaintiff, the injured victim's contract with the health care provider, which is entered into at the time the services are rendered. You walk in the hospital, you sign the admission forms, you go to the doctor's office, you sign a financial agreement. It is not for the reasonable value, as Mr. Lesch said. You agree to pay their billed amount. It's right there. In plain language, if you don't have insurance, you paid the billed amount. Now, what this insurance coverage provides is a mechanism. This is the second contract that you have. I paid premiums for a long period of time, a lot of premiums. I've invested in this contract. This insurance contract provides me with the mechanism to discharge that debt. I do not have to pay the billed amount paid by the healthcare provider. We're not talking about reasonable value at all on the first insurance contract. Now, if you don't have insurance, what's going to happen? One, you're responsible for the full value of the billed amount. Two, you get hit with a hospital lien. Don't forget the hospital lien statute. The hospital lien statute does, though, refer to reasonable necessary medical expenses. So it does require the hospital to step up and justify their bills. But we should be comparing the status of the plaintiff, whether they are insured or not insured, to determine whether or not there has been a benefit paid. And that is what this case should be all about. And again, discharge of the bill is all the plaintiff wants. And that is the benefit paid under the contract exception. It doesn't have to be by cash. It doesn't have to be what the insurance company pays out to the healthcare provider. It includes both the negotiated discounts and the cash payment. That is the benefit of the bargain. Now, we've had some discussion here about what does the plaintiff think of when they first purchase health insurance? You know, are they considering these discounts and this type of thing? Perhaps not. They are thinking about security. They are thinking about discharge of our bills. I want to pay the least premium I can, but I want discharge of a bill. Now, you want to see an eye-opener for any of you that may have practiced plaintiff's personal injury law. You sit across from the client at the first meeting and you tell them about subrogation. That is an eye-opener to the plaintiff. And that is something that is completely ignored in all these cases nationwide, is the benefit of the bargain carries with it just overwhelming burdens. Burdens of the bargain. Now, they want to reap the benefit of the bargain. They just want to pay the amount that was actually paid by the health insurer. Now, the question is, what effect does all this have on liability insurance? Well, I guess the liability insurer just hopes that Medicare is involved, because we know they're certainly not paying reasonable value. They're paying way below cost. So should the insurer, the liability insurer's liability depend upon the payment source that is available to the plaintiff to discharge the bill? I don't think so. It really should not. Then it is reaping the benefit of the bargain. We have premiums paid for, say, 10 years at $1,000 a month. Geez, that's a pretty good investment. That's a lot of money I put in to try to get my medical expenses discharged. But not only that, whoa, way back in the back of that contract, there is this subrogation clause. And it's not a subrogation clause anymore, Your Honor. When this bill was passed, we were all talking about subrogation. Oh, geez, you know, they can step in, they get to get a little bit of their money back and this type of thing. Look at the reimbursement language that is now before every one of these plaintiffs and every one of these health insurance policies. We get dollar one priority. We're not going to contribute to the cost of collection. We discount, absolutely disavow the common fund doctrine. We disavow the make whole doctrine. And not only that, such as in Mr. Tucker's case, if you're hit with 49% comparative negligence, we don't care. We don't care. You pay us 100% that we paid out. Now that is an eye-opener to a plaintiff. In Mr. Tucker's case, he was hit with 49% comparative, but he has to pay back 100% of the bills under his reimbursement provision. He doesn't pay back only 51% of them, the amount that he can recover. That is an overwhelming burden of the bargain. And that's what he's stuck with under his insurance contract. And you have to look at the realities of the totality of these contractual relationships. And we start mixing up contract law and tort law. They are responsible for the reasonable value of services rendered under tort law. Now, can they then get into the contractual aspects of both the contract between the injured party and the healthcare provider? Well, that's what they should be hit for, because if there wasn't insurance, that's the amount they'd have to pay. But because of this side contract, benefits paid under the contract exception, the plaintiff does get a break. There is no windfall. I think that's a really nice catchphrase that the tort reformers used way back when: windfalls, double recoveries, phantom damages. It sounds good, and I'm
well, ultimately in this case, what we're supposed to get is the intent of the General Assembly.
Correct.
So give us that already.
The intent of the General Assembly is to carve out this contract exception. One, we're going to avoid double recoveries. If you have a Medicaid patient, clearly there is a double recovery, a windfall profit at taxpayer expense. The courts say we're not going to allow that windfall to take place. At the same time, while we are concerned about double recoveries, we are not going to let the plaintiff bear the burden of a bargain and not allow the benefit of the bargain. The tortfeasor should be held for the reasonable value. And again, you have to look at the terms of the statute. I think that we can go outside the statute. I guess one question hasn't been asked so far in this case: is this particular statute ambiguous? I think in Van Waters, the court said the contract exception is ambiguous, at least as to the latter phrase, which was a contract entered into or paid by or for on behalf of such person. The court did hold that that part of the phrase was ambiguous. Now we are dealing with another phrase in the same contract exception: wholly or partially indemnified or compensated by a benefit paid. I know that there's been a lot of discussion about indemnification and compensation. To me, the catchphrase, though, is benefit paid. And as Mr. Lesh indicated, I don't believe that that's an ambiguous phrase using dictionary definitions. Benefit is some kind of an advantage. Paid is discharge of a debt. That discharge of a debt, here we're talking about medical expenses being discharged, and they include both the cash payments as well as the discounts negotiated.
But
that's a problem, though. I mean, Van Waters was such a simple case in comparison in some ways to what we're doing today, in that Mr. Van Waters was a fireman. He had a disability benefit coming to him as a result of that. It was really clear that someone had been paying for that, and that was a benefit. It was all very real, mm-hmm. Van Waters case. And here it all seems sort of illusory. You could discuss that.
I guess, first off, in Van Waters, the premium, so-called premium paid, were his services rendered as a fireman. And the court said, well, we're not going to use the term paid to include only a cash payment like a premium. We're going to expand that to include services rendered. I don't think it is illusory, Your Honor. I think that...
Well, Mr. Van Waters, illusory, I don't mean that in any negative or pejorative sense. It's just Mr. Van Waters was really getting some money. And here we're dealing with almost a construct or a theoretical idea of a damage or a benefit, to put it that way.
Yeah, and to me, I think that the appropriate way to rule is to address benefit of the bargain, which I think is clearly within Van Waters v. Keelan. I think it was adopted in Smith v. Zufelt. It's consistent with the common law. It's adopted by a majority. But most importantly, it is not just benefit of the bargain. It's benefit and burden of the bargain. In Keelan, there was no subrogation. And
I understand where you're coming from. I'm just curious about the language, which you were focusing on as well, as the benefit paid.
Right.
So the benefit is this differential. How is it paid?
Because payment is discharge of a debt.
Which didn't ever really exist, I guess. What?
No, that goes back to my original statement, Your Honor, that there was a debt at the outset. It was the contract that he entered into when he goes into the hospital. The debt exists.
Well, let's talk about that, because you go into the hospital, you get admitted, and you give them your insurance card, and immediately you're cataloged as this person who has this insurance, and therefore you will be charged this much. Isn't that right?
Yeah, but what if your insurance lapsed? What if you have a pre-existing condition?
Then you're categorized as a different person, and we're talking about a different ultimate cost. But if I go in, I give them my insurance card. That's how much I owe, is what my insurance card says. Or is that not right?
I don't believe that's correct. It's the discharge of the debt by both the discounts and the cash payments. And no, the liability does exist. You're still liable for deductibles, co-payments. And again, if your insurance somehow isn't available, you're stuck with the whole amount and they can lien you.
I could ask just one more question.
Of course.
But aren't I liable for, say I'm liable for 20% of what the insurance company pays? My bill is $10. It's discounted to $8. Aren't I liable then for 20% of the $8 as opposed to 20% of the $10? So in effect, my bill is the $8, not the $10.
And I have to say, I apologize. I didn't follow it. I apologize for that, Your Honor. I didn't quite understand your question.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, the court, I want to thank both counsel, all counsel, for your arguments. And the case.